Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, returning to take another psychological detour through a baffling true crime case as we endeavor to learn what truly happened in the death of a 27-year-old schoolteacher from Philadelphia, Ellen Greenberg, who was stabbed to death inside her apartment under circumstances in which it seems she was alone. So was it simply a rather bizarre and rare suicide, fueled by rage? Or did someone else wield the knife? Let's take a look. But first, there's just something I need to say for my own sake, and my regular listeners will undoubtedly understand why. As many of you know, I've had a very hard road over the last few years, in a situation in which prominent people have promised me writing opportunities that I earned, and then just ripped the rug out from underneath me, leaving me working overtime and getting completely burnt out, trying to correct the fallout from the horrible things they've done. What had been a difficult, everyday struggle turned into an impossible journey of digging myself out of a hole that other people created. And while I take responsibility for doing that work, those people who harmed me and caused these issues need to be held to account, even if only by my expression of the events that transpired. While I have had a great experience with nearly everyone I've associated with in the entertainment industry, there are two monsters, Dan Harmon and Brian Fuller, who I am going to address directly and extensively in an upcoming episode. So why now? Well, on my birthday earlier this month, I saw news that Dan Harmon's co-creator on Rick and Morty, Justin Roiland, had been charged with domestic violence involving corporal injury, along with false imprisonment of a woman he'd been dating. Afterward, people started coming forward showing text messages from when they were minors that basically confirmed what everybody had already realized, which is that Justin is a creep who chases after children. Dan had offered me a staff writing job on Rick and Morty beginning in April 2020 and then rescinded it right before I was about to leave for LA due to reasons that were complete bullshit and something I could not understand. For several years, as Dan turned his back on me, I was left to wonder what the hell really happened. I literally did nothing wrong at all. How could these people call my character into question? I mean, Dan literally played God over one of his writers in the community writers' room years ago because she didn't want to get with him. He fucking terrorized her, made her life miserable, and he's the type of asshole who makes excuses like, "Your heroes aren't who you think they are," to justify his shitty behavior instead of trying to uphold any decency. And when the news about Justin hit, it dawned on me, oh my God, I bet if I look at the time frame on these charges, they'll match the time Dan turned his back on me. And they did. The incident happened in January 2020, and the charges came in May 2020. Dan told me explicitly that he felt like he owed me another opportunity, but despite responding that I was willing to mop the floors anywhere he put me in order to prove myself, I received nothing but silence. That was after he told me to do absolutely nothing but continue working on my podcast for 8 months until the writing season started. So I did that. I stopped looking for other opportunities, and when the time came, he just did me dirty, right at the last minute. It did so much long-term damage to my life. My car even got repossessed as I was out of a job. None of this matters to Dan, because he's a narcissistic piece of shit. But Brian Fuller is even far worse, and we'll talk about him a lot. These events aren't companies pulling out of a business deal. These are influential people who tried to befriend me and claim to be champions of me and my work, something that I really needed as a neurodivergent person trying to earn even one creative opportunity. They're the type of people who could have easily done that for me and promised to do so, even without my asking, only so they could turn around and make my life hell forever instead. It's what miserable but influential people sometimes do to aspiring creatives who have no leverage. And again, rejection is always fine. Backing out of a business deal is fine. But lying to and gaslighting a genuinely decent person who has worked his entire life just to earn one opportunity is monstrous. They had the power to change my life, and they did. They destroyed it. I've never had a terrible experience with anybody in the entertainment industry except these two people, these fucking monsters. I was willing to overlook Brian Fuller's reputation as a terrible person because I know what made him that way. I have empathy. I was also willing to overlook Dan's reputation as someone who terrorizes women, given what he suffered, because I have empathy. But doing so cost me in ways I can't even begin to calculate. In an upcoming episode, we'll talk about why these bloated, narcissistic, and wealthy man-children terrorize other people to cope with their everlasting emotional wounds, when what they really need to do is finally take a good look in the fucking mirror. Neither of those two clowns found me on their own. Their heads are way too far up their egomaniacal asses to accomplish anything like that. It just so happens that the introduction of my show to monsters like this comes through the far greater decency of the women surrounding them, which easily shows you how these women believed my work would be a good influence on them. It was. But for being that insightful and illuminating soul, the light I shone upon them revealed things they didn't want to see about themselves, which were subsequently projected onto me as fault, leading to being cast aside in a circumstance where the universe sent me to help. They have money. They have fame. But they have absolutely no substance. And my internal flashlight lit up those empty places waiting to be filled. I'm sorry it scared them. Every day, I see another writer connect to somebody in some way that promises to change their life with the smallest measure, and I cheer for those people, always, but there's still a part of me that is left to wonder why it always has to be somebody else, and never me. It's like I watch this happen over and over, year after year, and the big party inside where all of those people gather is completely foreign to my experience. I look through the windows in the rain and cold, trying to lock eyes with someone who will see me and understand. But when the door finally opens, it's only the devil. In an industry in which 99.99% of everything equates to rejection, there is simply no room to falsely represent yourself as an angel with wings trying to lift me up, only to bring misery, suffering, and death to my desperate plight. So, I truly look forward to that upcoming episode, and if nothing else, as listeners, I'm sure it will provide interesting insights into human nature. Now, shifting gears back to the Ellen Greenberg case, it's January 26, 2011, in Philadelphia. Ellen's day begins at home, which is an apartment in Manayunk shared with her fiancé, Sam Goldberg, who was a local TV producer at the time. Before work, Ellen talks to her mom on the phone, and the elder woman suggested she didn't notice anything strange about the conversation, at least nothing to suggest what happened next. Around that time, as she and Sam had gotten engaged, Ellen was preoccupied with the planning of their upcoming wedding. But on this particular day, what was worrisome was a blizzard rolling into town. Now, in most true crime podcasts, where the people are sane hosting it, you just glance at that info and move along, and primarily because what most true crime stories are geared toward is placing psychological considerations last, like they're a sideshow or just an afterthought, leading to profound ignorance about the subject at hand that is easily avoided by simply prioritizing emotion. A murder or suicide begins as an emotional consideration, so examination should start there and then proceed into physicality, which is why cases like this, in which there is an obvious truth, become falsely mysterious. But for good reason. So let's start at the opposite end of the spectrum with the psychology. We'll ask, what is weather? But more specifically, what is the symbolic relevance of what we see rendered by weather systems? Well, each element, so to speak, afforded by the weather, as it comes from the sky, is meant to embody the Creator, but in a very specific binary way. Evolutionary refusal, or conversely, acceptance. Weather, as it is literally the changes in our physical atmosphere, must manifest those changes as a result of projecting from our emotional world. In our insufficient, even pitiful minds, due to the social veil, we believe the weather, or elements, simply exist to satisfy a physical component of life. But nothing does that. There is no such thing as normalcy. There is only symbolic imagery to tell a story. So everything is an emotional idea projected upon a physical palette. So if you look out your window and see that it's snowing, that visual, derived from emotional projection, has not only been created to satisfy your individual psychological world and those of every other person alive at the time who might see it, but also collectively incorporates our emotional life in totality as a species. The weather is not just something that happens, and it does not happen in the same way for everyone outside of its physical context. It projects from the emotional world to have a consistent meaning among people physically, such as there's 6 inches of snow on the ground. But emotionally, that snow has been crafted just for you. For that reason, all weather elements mimic the Creator's ascension in reverse. So, for instance, we understand the universe itself, or the Creator, or God, is the rising or ascending white light, essentially electricity, comprised of many tiny parts that disunited in the Big Bang and need to come back together as one. So to manifest that idea in physicality, we just get out our emotional mirror and reverse it. That means, instead of the white light rising and coming together on the way up to form one thing, it falls apart on the way down. The more snow that comes, aka the more white light that does not rise, which could be defined as the more unwilling you are to evolve, the more snow you get. It's basically saying, if you won't rise, I'll bury you in it, or I'll drown you in it if we're talking about rain, which takes on the same effect with raindrops. As they collect, just like the snow, you start to have problems related to movement, specifically forward and upward mobility, which are the backbone of evolutionary necessity in ascending from Earth. The same goes for lightning strikes. If you won't rapidly climb the evolutionary ladder, or Jacob's ladder to God above, or the straight white line of ascending light or electricity, it simply comes back down on you again and again, but instead of a straight line, it's disjointed over and over. So the reason people get really excited for snow days spent at home is that evolution stops, and therefore so does the expectation of ascension, and by extension, the guilt of not moving forward evaporates. So if you got snowed in, day one would be great, but there's a reason we have the term cabin fever, and it's because the toll of not moving forward begins to set in after a while. And of course, that's why the cold, more than anything else, has fueled our evolution. It works toward the overarching goal of evolution, which is simply this: get back inside. So if you simply go back inside by going into your house physically, your comfort is short-lived. But if you evolve emotionally in the direction of going back inside within the context of interdimensional evolution heading back to the beginning in the infinite loop, the resources flow. For instance, if I see a blizzard coming and decide to sit on my ass watching TV, free of concerns related to the snow, my path forward in life stops, meaning gainful evolution. But if I go out into the snow and use technology to literally plow a path forward where there wasn't one before and fuel evolution in that regard, people will offer me handsome rewards. Now, on the color scale, which originates as an emotional idea, as we talked about in the last episode in relation to a fetus, the brightest color, so to speak, which is not a color, but the combination of all colors, is white. Now, since that is an emotional idea at its root, it means the physicality of it, which we would expect to take on a meaning of being hot, actually reverses that idea and makes white weather elements, or snow, coldest. The idea is that what's coming down is reversed in a context of the white light falling down and apart rather than rising and coming together. So instead of the white light, like a white flame, being indicative of the greatest heat rising and dissipating, it shows us the opposite, which is the greatest extent of cold falling and solidifying. It has to mirror. The white light ascending is the creator, just as it would be with the father during a heterosexual act of intercourse between man and woman. And of course, that makes rain, aka the transparency, or the transition between Jesus and God in the form of the Holy Spirit. Rain equates to our emotional abyss, the place to which we descend emotionally into the unconscious mind and make our unrealized selves conscious by bringing them into the light where we will take on that new identity. So that's represented by Jesus. So that's represented by something like the Jesus character, the embodied man crossing the threshold of the Holy Spirit and becoming transparent through disembodiment, leaving transparent rain as the water used for the cleansing. It walks on your head from above, drop after drop, instead of you walking on the water below your feet, as a manifested means of creating a visual horror from your emotional necessity to evolve. So instead of all of the water being together as a body of water below your feet as one thing, like the singularity, you have it all broken apart above you and coming down on your head instead. It just reverses it to make it a horror instead of a successful evolutionary movement. When loss forces you to become someone new, the tears flow down your face in the same way as a warning about what will happen if you stop moving. You're going to drown emotionally. So during times of grief and reflection, the tears flow, and to show our emotional wound of not wanting to change, what do we desperately do? Wipe them away. We dry up the abyss because the abyss means leaving behind what was and becoming the thing we're meant to be moving forward. The more one has evolved, the less necessity there is for water used to cleanse in the abyss, and therefore, when the cleansing has been done, it dries up. So the idea of telling people not to cry over something is a means of telling them to move on. If there are no tears, there is no abyss. So when you cry, the body and mind are essentially just saying, hey, you need an abyss in which you'll change. So like, for instance, if your partner passed away and here you are crying and you realize, shit, I need to go down into the abyss and become somebody else, somebody new. And the basis or theme of that, the premise for your change, is going to be, who am I without the other person? So when we encounter loss, we have to recalibrate our future selves, and that happens through change in the abyss. And so the symbolic necessity for pushing that idea or precipitating those movements is the tears of crying. So when clouds are white and not about to rain, they appear weightless, high in the sky and floating with ease. Yet if we take those clouds down the color scale to gray by mixing some darkness with that white light, what do we notice about the cloud cover? It's not only much lower, but seemingly dense and heavier due to water, and not even close to appearing weightless. Instead, the clouds seem right overhead, closing in, menacing in a way that they seem like a wall between the light above and the resulting darkness below. And what do we say the sun finally does in situations like this, which is the same as we describe when we see the light through that cloud cover? We call it a breakthrough. You can see the light, which always equates to truth. Yet, what will become important to us here is that nature of what's being blocked by the clouds. If the sky wasn't gray, what color would it be? Blue. Blue is the color of that which is new, or blue shifted light, and red, of course, represents that which has passed us by, or red shifted light. In the universe, as I've mentioned many times, when you view the stars going away from us, or older stars, their light is red-shifted, while younger stars, or those which are coming toward us, are blue-shifted. So when the weather yields rain or snow, which are literally called precipitation because that's what they're trying to do in kicking your emotional world into gear to change, the first thing that gets extracted is the color of that which is new, or change, blue. The blue sky disappears because the weather is saying, in the context of precipitating your actions to come, there is nothing new, aka blue sky, to which you can ascend, which means you can't become the rising white light, and instead will become trapped. The snow buries you, while the rain drowns you, as a means of limiting your movement and foreshadowing the horror stagnancy brings into your life physically by indulging it emotionally. And so, if we look at those ideas of drowning or being buried alive, what do we understand would be rendered by that? Asphyxiation or suffocation, right? Well, of course, our victim, in this case, on an emotional level, is going to be seeking suicide methods related to what? Suffocation. Now, if it rains too hard or snows too much, what happens? It becomes harder and harder to move until finally you get stuck and die if you don't change. The wrath of nature is simply the call to evolve. When the first humans with the capacity to find or build shelter got rained or snowed on, the physical conditions precipitated by these events caused them to ask one question and one only, which is the backbone of evolutionary function. How do I get back inside? Just like a baby born from its mother's womb suffers the emotional fallout of never being able to get back inside, we, as a species, have that collective wound of being born to that which abandons us, and therefore ask, how do I get back inside? If you're a heterosexual man, you're born from a woman, grow up, and deal with your wound of not being able to get back inside the mother's womb through sexuality, which means that, for a man like this in physicality, the transcendence of becoming the father through the ascending white light creates a baby. In your life, by way of perception, you believe that babies are the basis for evolution, for creating the next generation, and a wonderful thing. And they are. But beneath that societal veil of cuteness, the ugly truth is that we manifest the idea of becoming the father over and over in physicality as a means of coping with our inadequacy of not being able to transcend him emotionally. Babies are born from the ego and not from the authentic self, which has only one true identity, the One. So every time you indulge this manifested physicality of becoming the father with embodiment instead of creating emotional movement toward disembodiment over time, the Creator simply kills those people you create. All of them. No matter how many little smiling faces you pop out, that which has created us will kill them. It might happen at birth or more than 100 years later, but embodiment always and without exception leads to slaughter. By design, we live in a society that's been designed to fail to precipitate constant change, one that is therefore veiled by necessity, instead being the product of wrongdoing and free will in the form of bad people and choices. But it all takes place within the context of an evolutionary roadmap that succeeds because, beneath that veil of perception, all that we see and do is necessary. Just like characters in a movie, we don't know that, despite our arrogant assertions of free will and choices, and being an autonomous creature who controls its own destiny, underneath that veil, We are truly puppets, simply moving images on a screen and dolls to fulfill the purpose of being products of dramatic necessity utilized to tell a story. So on January 26, 2011, as a blizzard rolls in and we understand Ellen Greenberg is going to be stabbed to death in a situation in which her psychological disposition played a part, it needs to be our primary focus. Here, as the weather would be considered extraordinary in the form of a blizzard, the first thing we'll ask is what that means to a person intuitively. That's the key. You are designed to absorb symbolism intuitively unless you're analyzing something with the express purpose of finding such things. Our minds are constructed of the unconscious, or below the surface, and subconscious, the gateway between the unconscious and the conscious, and then finally, the conscious or rational mind. Things residing in the unconscious mind are intuitive, while that which bridges the gap between the unconscious and conscious, in the form of the subconscious, is the place from which intuitive ideas finally become realized in the conscious mind. The subconscious is the junction between that which is only intuitively realized below in darkness and that which is explicitly understood above in the light. So in terms of your perception, heavy snowfall, limiting movement, and making you feel trapped with no way out can deeply affect your emotional state through symbolic imagery and the absence of your explicit understanding of why it's happening at all. And if it happens, because you utilize your conscious mind to ask yourself, what's wrong? The conscious mind can't lead you down the right path because it simply has no knowledge of that which resides in your unconscious. So what happens is this. Your brain makes a connection intuitively through symbolic imagery in your unconscious, and then also does the same through your conscious mind, but with the necessity for there to be a correlation between the internal feelings and external events in our physical reality. For instance, if heavy snow is falling, reversing the idea of the white light ascending and solidifying as one, or rising to become the Father, then what that snow represents symbolically and in physicality is the coming of the Father, but even more specifically, the notion that the Father won't stop coming down on you instead of going the other way, meaning evolving upward. So we ask ourselves, in the context of this story, as the blizzard brings heavy snowfall that afternoon, which traps Ellen and Sam inside their home, who would be the emotional idea of the Father on the inside that parallels the projected physical reality of the snowfall effect seen outside? That's how our reality is built. What she sees when looking out at the weather and what it makes her feel in terms of being trapped by the Father coming down on her instead of making her rise is what she's feeling on the inside in relation to something negative in her personal life. So if snow coming down is symbolizing the Father coming down on her again and again, burying her, making it hard to move, instead of helping her rise and making her feel weightless, we're specifically talking about a failure to transcend to becoming the Father. That's the reason for the precipitation. Growth, just like it is in the relationship between living things and water. Without precipitation, on a physical level, we'll die, and the same is true emotionally. Now, if we examine Ellen's life just on a cursory level, what should be immediately apparent is that the man transcending to become the Father, so to speak, by marrying her as a husband and taking the place of her father symbolically, is her fiancé, Sam, and he's the only person there. No matter how thorough the following details about this death become, there won't be a point at which we can identify the presence of an intruder. And that's because if you manifest the idea of the snow falling as the Father coming down on you and trapping you, then the opposite, which is the white light rising, ends in the Father disappearing until he returns. Here, the events precipitating this death seem to follow suit. Let's take a look. There's no way for us to know exactly when Ellen died, but it seems as though her computer was last used around 4:45 p.m. or so. Sam, according to CCTV at the building where they live, enters the gym downstairs in the basement at 4:54 p.m. He only stays down there approximately 35 minutes, at which point he heads upstairs and, according to him, finds a surprise. The door to their apartment is locked, but it's only the bar latch that a person would use if they wanted to open the door a bit to engage with someone outside in the absence of unlocking it. Sam knocks, but he doesn't want to break down the door, so he waits outside and calls Ellen. She doesn't pick up. He texts her and soon after sends an email. The texting continues for about 25 minutes, give or take, as Sam tries to get a hold of Ellen, but fails. His text would later show that he became increasingly annoyed, but there were no threats or references to anything like a fight that precipitated the action of not responding to his messages. The text didn't indicate that he felt like she was doing this purposely, along with shutting him out of the apartment. What's interesting, however, is that even though Sam doesn't say or write anything that foreshadows violence hiding behind it, he does seem to show a lack of concern for Ellen's well-being. None of this communication is asking, "Are you okay?" There also doesn't seem to be any urgency to break down the door. Given that Sam's workout was 35 minutes and his fiancée was contacted continually for no less than 25 minutes thereafter, and the door doesn't get broken down until 6:30 p.m., one would think that Sam might adopt a level of urgency conducive to believing this is an emergency. But he doesn't. After having no luck upstairs getting into the apartment and not wanting to break down the door, Sam goes to the doorman in the main lobby and asks him if he can help to break down his apartment door. The guy refuses, of course, but says he's willing to call Ellen, to which there is no response. He also says, in lieu of that, that they can call the police, and Sam doesn't want to do that yet. So Sam goes back upstairs to break down the door. But let's pause to ask why Sam hasn't opted to call somebody like one of Ellen's friends or her mother to see if they can call her and get a different result. It seems like a good idea, but upon further reflection, you realize that insinuating that she wouldn't answer the door for him, but would for her mother or friends, means that he's done something terribly wrong to have her lock him out. And in a situation in which she's about to be found dead, that looks beyond suspicious. Now, Sam does break down the door around 6:30 p.m., he causes very little damage to the lock, though the photos do seem to suggest that the drywall is cracked and the screws were at least partially pulled out to make that happen. It seems Sam put a light shoulder into it, so light in fact, that he literally managed to get lots of people to wonder if he ever broke down the door at all. And what does that say if we look more closely? When he broke down the door, he did so very gently and with no urgency, which is counterintuitive to how someone should react in a circumstance in which they believe the person inside, even their fiancé, would have no reason to be unavailable for so long. He left at 4:54 p.m. and broke down the door over an hour and a half later, so I do think, within that time frame, he could have ascertained that she wasn't sleeping or in the shower. But it's hard to say. Sometimes when we don't want anything to be wrong, but intuitively know there is something quite wrong, we use denial to fend off scary thoughts. So, this is when Sam enters the apartment and finds Ellen dead in the kitchen, lying in a pool of blood. it's not entirely apparent from the 911 call what position she's in at the time, but we can see from the crime scene photos and associated blood that she was on the floor in front of the cabinets. It's possible she was seated with her back against them, or even flat on her back, but what we can say is that if she was moved, it was only in terms of positioning, and there's no chance the crime happened elsewhere. Now, she's been stabbed 20 times with a 10-inch serrated kitchen knife from the block on the counter, which was found tipped over but otherwise undisturbed. 10 of the wounds have damaged the area on the back of her head and neck, and there's a large deep gash in her scalp, along with a deep wound to the abdomen. The remaining 8 injuries all consisted of stab wounds to the chest area, with the final one being the serrated knife plunged at least 4 inches into her heart and left there with her grip still on it. Depending on the source, Ellen seems to have possibly been either right or left-handed, but what's consistent in the reporting is that the knife was found in her non-dominant hand, which is a technique sometimes employed by the rare people who stab themselves and then blame someone else or make their death appear to be as the result of someone else, either as a form of revenge or simply to diminish the shame involved by never allowing anyone to definitively suggest that it was just a suicide. Cindy James is a great example. She seemingly perpetrated an entirely unsubstantiated stalking event over a long period of time in which a phantom repeatedly entered her home and terrorized her until finally she succumbed to him through death. The mentally ill, specifically those either on the verge of psychosis or entrenched in it, manifest the home, or even just the indoors, as the brain in the worst possible way, and therefore, because an emotional life or psychological disposition can't be seen, neither can the perpetrator manifested by it. The victim is crying out in silence for everybody to realize that when there is nowhere left to look inside the home, the problem should be realized as being inside her head. But she can't tell you, she's not willing. If she could, you wouldn't have ended up in a place that she was communicating through symbolism, which is what the psychotic often do in the absence of truly being able to veil their communications in subtext and be understood. Accordingly, in this Ellen Greenberg case, there's no sign of a physical struggle in the kitchen, despite a stabbing involving 20 wounds. There are no smears from anyone's shoes in the blood, nor are there defensive wounds or foreign DNA from strangers anywhere on Ellen's body. Furthermore, with the bar latch being engaged and no sign of entry or exit in the fresh snow on the balcony or anywhere else, there simply doesn't seem to be a way to substantiate an intruder. So, with Cindy James, who is strongly rumored to have suffered a very abusive childhood in relation to a father figure that continued to haunt her emotionally into adulthood, preventing her from ever breaking free because she couldn't talk about it, we find her manifesting a phantom, absent embodiment, to signify the father. Each time she tells anyone of the man in black, there's never any proof he was there. To the contrary, what appears to have happened in each incident is that, even though she tried to make it appear like someone else hurt her, she did it to herself. Abused people can often remain loyal to the dysfunction into adulthood, and specifically and most often through a conduit of secrecy. But because that secrecy prevents release, sometimes people blow and that lava comes out, but in the form of their own spilled blood. What I see here to this point in the story is an evolutionary issue related to transcendence and the father. Our entire evolutionary narrative is about the absence of the father, meaning leaving him at the beginning in the infinite loop and going back to him at the end, having become him by way of technology or sophistication, just like a child growing to an adult through the guidance of a parent. So no matter what we do in life, we can't escape becoming the father we left behind and repeating that same fate eternally. That means that if you left an abusive father behind by growing up physically, he will remain with you, disembodied thereafter, in that context of the same entity emotionally. So if there was abuse involved in your childhood, combined with that repetition and secrecy of which I speak, it might later manifest as that man coming after you physically when he's not really there. If we refuse the emotional enlightenment and indulge secrecy and denial, a fire grows down below in our unconscious mind due to lack of release and makes us experience anxiety so bad that we'll do anything to get out, except break the silence and cycle of abuse. So that red giant grows and grows inside you, but specifically inside your unconscious mind, in an effort to precipitate movement without explicit understanding. Feelings are simply emotional weather, so to speak, and emotional precipitation, and the feeling of anxiety, when manifested, is like being on fire. You need to get away and put out the fire, but no matter where you run or what you do, it just keeps on burning because it's really inside you. You're supposed to be moved to look down there, realize the truth, and act accordingly. But if you're past the point of repair, all you'll find is the literal version of that through a manifestation. So, Cindy James ultimately set her basement on fire and stood there in the flames screaming to be rescued while swearing to the existence of a phantom man who set the blaze but took off. When nobody could be found, she just pointed to a man walking down the street who promptly took off running. At first, they desperately wanted to believe that man was guilty, but soon realized he was running from her because she was crazy. She was psychotic. Whomever that was had nothing to do with the fire. But look at how proximity, combined with desperation, make that man a suspect, even in a situation in which the subject of the complaints is severely mentally ill. And here, in this story with Ellen, what we learn is that she was suffering from extreme levels of anxiety. So, as Cindy James was unwilling to face her demons, she was also unwilling to get help by default of blaming the downfall of her emotional world internally on false considerations based in physicality. The person coming to get her was in the past, in the form of an abusive father figure. So here, in this case involving Ellen Greenberg, the source of her mental illness, which does seem to have descended to psychosis, has some sort of a correlation to a man breaking her heart. It could have been in childhood involving a male family member, or it could have been as recently as her relationship with Sam. Whatever happened, it was painful at first, but just a prick, and over time, the wounds got deeper and deeper, until finally, the last one was the one that killed her. It went into her heart. It broke her heart. That's what happens here. There is a very clear narrative in that idea, and when we examine the numerous wounds around the head and neck area of Ellen's body, what we see is that some of them are what we would describe as hesitation wounds, meaning the horrors of stabbing herself induced hesitation, or perhaps more practically, conservatism, which led her to gauge these strikes in a manner that she wouldn't do one thing in the end. And the revelation of it, this truth, is so sad. from looking at the wounds that start out pricking her at about 0.2 centimeters and then gradually get deeper and deeper, finally rendering death with a single blow to the heart? What we clearly see is a concentrated and calculated effort to not feel any more pain than she had to endure in order to bring herself peace. So, what did Ellen's search history reveal on her computer just weeks before her death? She browsed through a website dedicated to experiencing a painless death through suicide. Even a month earlier, in December, Ellen searched online for suicide methods, even indulging the idea of suffocating herself by putting a bag over her head. People comment about this crime scene in the context of there being very little blood, given the intention of a stabbing and 20 wounds leading to death perpetrated with a kitchen knife. And that efficiency is due to the perpetrator not using 1 ounce more effort than what was necessary because it amounted to what? Pain. In the weeks leading up to her death, Ellen even began seeing a therapist and also started taking medication for anxiety, which seemed out of control. This is someone headed down the drain and desperately fighting her inner demons along the way. There's no question her struggles were going to have a seriously debilitating effect on her relationship with Sam, and that whatever issues arose due to her heightened sensitivity, any one of those altercations to follow, even if minor, could have sent her over the edge. We have to think of the cumulative psychological toll of her ongoing plight and how thinking of suicide but not acting built the explosion to follow. She wanted to go out easily and quietly, but was pushed to greater violence and greater haste because simply she was not getting the release she needed, and so she exploded. That became blood. Now, the victim always tells us the disembodiment was in relation to a cleansing in the abyss leading to the white light, and does it through symbolic imagery. Even if your poor little Josephine Otero hanging from a sewer pipe while the disgusting BTK masturbates to completion in front of you. Either way, the straight line of the white light symbolizing the father will be present. So in this case, while Ellen allegedly has one hand on the knife in her chest, the other is clutching a white towel from the bathroom. So if you ask yourself what that would be for inside the bathroom, I mean, it seems that white towel would be to dry yourself after a cleansing in the abyss of the shower, or if it was a hand towel, the cleansing in the sink. Now, in our evolutionary narrative, the body, or Christ, dies and we are cleansed of that blood over the course of our evolution by way of suffering that ultimately brings the purity of the white light. So here, to symbolize that binary function, one of Ellen's hands holds the knife that leads to the suffering and spilling of Christ's blood that facilitates disembodiment by crossing the threshold of the Holy Spirit and walking on water. You walk on water by rising from the abyss cleansed of blood or mortality, at which point you ascend further to become the straight line of the white light. So the body of evolution, or the heart, is Christ, and the disembodied mind that we become, ultimately, is God. Therefore, in one hand, Ellen symbolizes the killing of the body, or heart, by way of the straight line, via the knife in her chest. And with the other hand, or binary counterpart, on the other side of her body, she shows us the result of that, which is the straight white line of the towel to manifest the idea of becoming God. In between those two places, or in the middle, just as would happen with Christ crossing the threshold and becoming the Holy Spirit, her dead body would decompose entirely, if left there long enough, satisfying the idea of disembodiment, but in a manifested physical way. So, we have a complete evolutionary narrative apparent here on the floor. We can see what she was trying to do. Now, on our bodies, action, or manifestation of ourself visually, occurs below the mind, in the body. Action is the what, specifically, what happened. Yet above, in our brains, is where we know why. Therefore, since this is manifested in physicality, we'll find that truth above the bridge, so to speak, or above the surface, or above the place where the body gets left behind, in the abyss. Here, that's the countertop. Below is the dead body, just like Christ gets left down in the abyss as a mortal human and rises as a deity to disappear. So here on the counter is where we find what Ellen was doing before she died. Symbolic imagery will tell us why this event happened, and again, we have to get out our emotional mirror. Now, what I believe most likely happened here is that these two had some type of climactic argument that both emotionally and physically, yet for the same purpose, drove them apart. Here we go. On the counter above Ellen, we have a large amount of fruit. So, right away, the manifestation of the abundance of fruit tells us to look in the emotional mirror, and what we'll see being hidden is a truth that something, on an emotional level, is not bearing fruit in this home. So what might it be? Let's concentrate on the fruit Ellen has actually been engaging, as the shapes, aka symbols she indulges in construction, will guide us to correlations with rational ideas derived from reason and logic. So the first thing we see in that regard is an orange that has specifically been peeled and then cut in half. What is being conveyed here is that when the protective layer of the emotional wound, or lie, was shed in favor of the truth below, it caused a halving, or split, between two previously connected elements serving as one unit. The cutting of an orange in two, once peeled, is acknowledgement of permanent disunity caused by a lie. So, what we see in the fact that the orange peel has been removed is not only just that a lie has been exposed as the raw, vulnerable truth beneath, but that the circle, or peel, has been broken. A broken circle is indicative of a broken bond, so it isn't any surprise that Ellen had taken off her engagement ring and left it in the bedroom right before this incident. The split in question relates to the couple. Now, as the circle is the home in our evolutionary narrative, and moving along the color scale toward red, while expanding, indicates the end, we should see a manifestation of reducing that red circle and taking it back across the color scale to a place conducive to a fresh start or something new, meaning starting anew. And of course, we would want an abundance of that in our lives. Yet to get there, to have those fresh starts, we constantly have to be cleansed of the expanding red giant over and over. The red giant, like the fire in Cindy James's basement, precipitates the truth by forcing tragic fate. If there's a fire in your basement, you have to run up the fucking stairs and out of the house. And that's basically how a sociopath, or even somebody psychotic, jailbreaks a criminal act in which symbolism is employed rather than reason and logic. So here, the circle, so to speak, on the counter starts as a very large circle that has nearly grown red in the form of the orange. And of course, it's an orange giant rather than a red one, because what it's saying is that this act is going to precipitate the next increment on the color scale, which moving in that direction from orange would be red. And so the red giant is coming next. This is foreshadowing the red giant. And of course, that happens. She spills her blood right after this. Okay, so let's just give a quick example of how evolution uses the breaking or peeling of the orange circle. For instance, in the legendary 1980s movie Silver Bullet, the horror movie which is based on the Stephen King graphic novel, we have a young protagonist who is in a wheelchair. And there's a girl who likes him. And of course, she's not in a wheelchair. And so when her father sees her with him, he thinks poorly of this. And he comments to her about how she shouldn't be hanging out with him. And of course, that's a very primitive way of behaving, and he needs to evolve. And so what happens is that since he's wrestling with this in his mind, he then goes into the house and he's watching a wrestling match on TV. He suddenly hears noises outside, meaning noises in his head, and he goes outside to the greenhouse. And when going in, he realizes that it seems like the plants are shaking, right? There are these green plants or green growth hanging above, meaning suspension, and they're in these orange pots. And suddenly, these pots start falling off the growth. They start falling off the plants. They're breaking, just peeling off like the orange peels, and they're falling to the ground. And what's happening is that these horrors are manifesting to say, dude, you need to change. You need to take off that protective layer, because the idea is that as we evolve, we move away from being the beast and toward being the light. And so basically, he's in a greenhouse and above him is only light and transparency, meaning universal truth and the light of God. And here we have this growth telling him you have to break the orange circle, because if you don't, what happens next is going to be the red circle or the red giant. And so he's looking at these potted plants breaking and he's not getting it. And so because he's not getting it, just like in this case we're talking about, the next thing that's going to come is death. And what happens is the abyss, which is below the floorboards, a werewolf explodes right up through the boards and drags him down into the abyss and kills him. And so that's symbolically saying that he remained the beast. And so he's being pulled back down into the abyss rather than rising by being accepting of the kid in the wheelchair and saying, hey, that's great that you're with him. He seems like a great kid. So he was wrestling with the idea of trying to evolve or not. And since he did not act and he's just sitting there, nature precipitates a circumstance in which he has to get up and go deal with this physically. And because he doesn't get the message, he doesn't read the symbolic advertisement, what ends up happening is he gets killed because he never moves emotionally. So once the truth is forced out about the split by way of the red giant, or achieving release, such as when we have a really bad argument with a significant other that leads to a terrible revelation putting the relationship at risk of a split, sometimes the truth that has been revealed makes moving forward irreconcilable against the work it would take to get there, or the work it would take to reduce the expanding red giant or circle of the past. So think of a fruit that needs to be consumed when very fresh, meaning it can't build up its outside armor or protective layer of lies that hides what's vulnerable beneath. So if you're eating it, you're always getting a fresh start. Now, again, think of something that's blue, like the blue shifted light we talked about that signifies what's coming toward us, aka the future or what's new. And because that new light or future is represented by blue, it's also much cooler, like calming from an argument when compared emotionally. And like I said, reduced greatly in size. Now, that argument leading to the removal of the engagement ring would have taken place as a result of strain on the relationship requiring a fresh start. So what we see here on the counter is a strainer full of blueberries that has already gone through a cleansing. It's an endless bowl of symbolic fresh starts. Yet it's bullshit because it's the manifested equivalent of the emotional issue that's consuming Ellen. Therefore, she manifests the idea of consuming it instead, allowing herself to believe the relationship will bear fruit in a fresh start once they cool off and begin anew. It's what she's trying to believe here, even if only on an intuitive level and not rationally. Yet blueberries aren't going to save anyone's relationship. To the contrary, guess what these berries are known for? Blueberries have one prominent health benefit that is advertised above and beyond any other consideration. They improve arterial flow, which is another obvious way of saying they increase your blood flow. And what happens next, even before the blueberries can be eaten, is that Ellen's blood flows all over the floor. Now, the scene will also tell us where the problem really was. So, if we ask what type of fruit is most often used to describe a human head, that would be a melon. And here we have a melon sitting next to the knife block that's knocked over, which makes it appear as though the straight lines of the knives stuck inside, just like the stab wounds below on Ellen, are aimed at the melon, even seemingly going through it at that angle. What is being said symbolically is that the circle that needed to be broken was an emotional cycle inside of her head, which is normally indicative of abuse. You have to use the ascending straight line of evolution to break the cycle. So the theme of the symbolic imagery found on the counter above Ellen in physicality is bearing fruit, which means the truth beneath that protective layer, or lie, like the shedding of the orange peel and having of the fruit inside, is the opposite, according to the emotional mirror, in the sense that it was a lie. The relationship was no longer bearing fruit, so she manifested that idea. But we can see from this setup that she desperately wanted her relationship to bear fruit. She simply did not have an emotional solution. And because she had no emotional solutions left, we see what would happen in the aftermath, which is a physical solution, and that took place. The fact that her relationship was no longer bearing fruit was consuming her inside emotionally, and so she decided to reverse course and manifest the consumption of born fruit outside physically, again to manifest false balance. But it's a lie, so you can see why she was moved to take a more extreme measure. Now, if she manifests ascension or going up by disembodying, through a cleansing, then what we understand from the orange, structurally, is that Sam must separate and go down in his effort to manifest a cleansing that will bring a fresh start. Except men think a little differently. We think in a context of architecture most times, meaning we build what needs to be manifested, but also fix the structure of things that are broken. So, in this instance, we should see Sam espousing physical manifestations of the ideas of both building and repairing something, and since men think in the context of physical strength due to our evolutionary past, it will be in a context of getting stronger. So we have to ask, what is the male version of the strainer here? How is Sam going to manifest the idea of reducing that stress or strain, aka reducing the emotional red giant? Well, just like Ellen seems to want to heal the relationship, Sam is going to tell us through his actions that he wants to work things out. Therefore, he literally goes downstairs in the opposite direction, separating from her like the orange halves once the truth has come out, and is manifesting reconciliation by doing something literally called working out. And strangely, he's wearing Timberlands at the time, which are styled in the form of construction boots. You put them on with the intention of building something or going to work on something. They take you through the place it's as toughest to walk in life. And that's what he's saying here. Sam is going to work things out with Ellen so they can build something together. But first he needs to undergo the cleansing of the red giant to cool off. So for him, it isn't the oranges leading to blueberries. It's the expansion of his muscles through activities like running and lifting weights, which cause what? We know it has to be the same as what Ellen is experiencing, right? But they're going to be on opposite sides. So she's going to have improved arterial flow outside the body, and he will mirror that with his improved arterial flow within the body. So improved arterial flow to the necessary places inside you precipitates healing that specifically makes you grow stronger. But you can only run in place at the gym. You don't go anywhere. And no matter how much you lift or how often, the strength will only be physical. And so here, Sam is taking the same route of indulging physicality rather than an emotional solution. So, when Ellen tries to manifest her ascension from the abyss, it's only physical, which means when Sam rises after his workout, the ascent will happen simply by way of the elevator, and emotionally, he will have gone absolutely nowhere at all. That's what happens. He goes up, only in the form of going up in the elevator, and comes back to the apartment. Obviously, there's no way for us to know exactly what took place prior to the death in question, but I think the following information offers a clue. Now, here's where it gets strange, or I should say, it already got strange, because unbeknownst to anyone else at that moment of truth, Sam has already made a phone call and received one in return, which draws a lot of suspicion. Before Sam broke down the door or showed any level of concern for the horrors inside, he apparently used his cell phone to not only call a good friend, but to subsequently answer a call soon after from that guy's father, who was an attorney. So after the gym and the texting, when it becomes apparent the door will need to be broken down, Sam first calls a contact who then seems to get in touch with his father, an attorney. But the big question is this, of course. Why does Sam need an attorney at this point? He hasn't even expressed an inclination to believe something is wrong. He's not acting urgently. And that makes us wonder if it's because he already knew there was a problem, a big one in fact, because he caused it in the form of murder. Now, we could say that Sam killed Ellen and simply cleaned up before leaving, only to return to a staged accident, one he wanted the doorman to find with him so the doorman could validate that the bar latch was not yet broken. It sounds perfectly reasonable, but from start to finish in this case, nobody seems to substantiate a notion of murder past the potential for it. There just isn't any solid evidence that a murder was committed unless you want to examine the prophecies of medical experts rather than the realities of what occurred. The danger in having experts look at wounds post-mortem is that they can make no allowance for the victim's unique experience in their assessment. Their assessment is born of generality, which is the safe and effective play, but it also means that in times of exceptional circumstances, we can end up with assertions of impossibility in situations in which it simply cannot be measured in a manner that excludes possibility. Ellen received a wound to her spinal cord due to one of the stabs that a medical examiner deemed consistent with paralysis that would prevent further motion, and therefore, that set off a firestorm of people believing that we would have a completely disabled victim being stabbed to death, leading to a crime scene absent of struggle. That's a little ridiculous. Possible? Yes, of course, but we don't have enough in the way of entry and exit, along with the stabbing itself, to suggest the presence of an intruder, even if that intruder is Sam himself. The perfection that would have had to accompany his movements is off the charts. So, I believe Sam didn't find Ellen until breaking down the door, but given the fact he already called an attorney, it seems clear he was concerned about liability, which, at its core, asserts that he knew the likelihood of what had happened. I believe he very simply suspected that she had taken her life, either because she had threatened it right before he left, or was otherwise in very bad shape psychologically at that point meaning at the culmination of an argument, and he feared the consequences of forcefully breaking down a door with a dead woman behind it for reasons any innocent person probably shouldn't have to explain, beyond the idea that it would look like a maniac barged in and attacked her. And if that maniac is you, the police might not look for anyone else, so you better think carefully about how you approach this. That's clearly why Sam wants someone, meaning the doorman, to accompany him as he breaks down the door, because that will verify that it was not broken down until they both had arrived and verified it to be true. Instead, Sam does it as lightly as possible, breaking the door, barely, and leaving many to wonder if it had ever been broken down at all. It's been suggested that he might have just walked in and out freely and caused the damage of his own volition in the aftermath to fool the police. But if he went down to the doorman and the doorman accepted, only to find the door already broken down, it would be game over for Sam, so I truly doubt he did that. I believe the reality of what likely occurred in terms of a suicide dawned on Sam as he grew impatient. It's even possible that Ellen had become so angry that she set him up to break down the door in a situation in which her suicide would then seem to be murder. Then the neighbors would hear him yelling and banging on the door and finally breaking it down before she ends up dead. It's certainly not kind to speculate that a victim might have been thinking such a bad thing, but in the heat of the moment, it's realistic. I honestly think she was manifesting the idea of killing herself physically so that when Sam arrived to find her dead of stab wounds, he could see how he killed her over time, starting with those little pricks and finally breaking her heart. And when he comes to help, it happens too late when he comes to break down the door. So it almost seems like Sam has been set up to experience an emotional narrative based in the symbolism of what she's trying to say. These death scenes are always intended for an audience, whether it's a lover or the police. But either way, in the end, you'll know how they died and why. If he came to realize why he had been locked out and tried to rush in to save her, it would be too late. And right there is the ugly motive for most violent incidents like this, even when it's suicide and not murder. Revenge. I think this result was rendered by an emotionally irreconcilable relationship that ran its course, and that angle is being suppressed by the surviving fiancé Sam in an effort to limit or even negate his liability in the matter. If he was found to have driven her to this ending, in any way, there could be culpability, whether in a criminal sense or even just in terms of incurring civil penalties. So let's quickly talk about the content of the 911 call, and I think what we'll see is someone who is desperately avoiding knowledge of the situation at hand because he doesn't want to admit anything over the phone. The less he knows and professes to know on the call, the better. It is so obvious this person spoke to an attorney beforehand because he is going to proceed to deny some fairly obvious elements that are apparent. But I think what I really find bothersome is that most people look at this case, and instead of considering that he has already talked to an attorney, they're like, oh my God, the 911 call is so strange, and it's not. It's not strange at all. It is perfectly in alignment with what an attorney would tell you to do in this situation, which is to feign as much ignorance as possible and to say as little as you could possibly say on the 911 call. That's what he does. It isn't mysterious. It isn't strange. It is strategic. But to a certain extent, it's also bullshit because what he's doing, instead of telling the full truth, is trying to limit his liability. So, for instance, he is just going to happen to not notice the knife buried in Ellen's chest. Sam goes through the 911 call with a strong and apparent desire to limit his liability as much as possible in terms of saying what he knows on a recorded phone call. But I think we'll see that his selfishness stems from being in survival mode. Once Ellen is dead and he's left under suspicion, his greater concern is no longer her, but availing himself of suspicion, and we hear it in his answers. Again, as selfish as it sounds, it's still true that once Ellen is dead, which she obviously was by that time, the only person Sam could save was himself. Despite anything he did wrong, he had every reason to believe he should limit his liability in the event someone had died inside the apartment. I mean, if she was searching the internet for ways to suffocate herself a month prior to her death and already browsing euthanasia info, it's very likely Sam knew of her worsening mental illness and that she was on the brink of disaster. When he only got silence upon knocking on that door, his intuition kicked in and he knew she was dead from suicide. I have literally been in this position. I have been that person at the door with somebody dead on the other side from a suicide. I know what this is like. And when you knock on that door, you fucking know it. And what's also terrifying is that you're like, shit, I have to go in there. And if this person who has been severely mentally ill for a very long time and suicidal is dead, that could cause liability for me. Right? People look out for themselves in a context of survival when they are no longer able to help the other person. So when I went to the door and knocked on it and couldn't go inside, my concern became my liability because I was trained over the course of years to understand that one day when I came home, my severely mentally ill and alcoholic mother would be dead of a suicide. I always knew that. It was just a matter of what day it was going to be. There were many times where I walked in and there was either a suicide in planning or one that had failed because she passed out from being drunk or anything in between. And so when you live this kind of life and you come home to your door and you don't know that you can actually walk inside and find everybody alive, you do start to think about things like your own survival and your own liability because you have already been down the road with this person who can't be fixed. You just know it. So I don't see Sam's behavior as that strange. I see it as intentional. He is trying to limit potential liability. So when Sam spoke with that attorney, undoubtedly he was told to limit what he said to 911 in the strictest possible terms, the foremost consideration of which would be to know how she died. So in the call, Sam seemingly pretends to not see the knife and moves forward under an assumption that she hit her head, which is plausible, even if only barely, because she truly does have a bleeding gash on her head that could lead one to believe she fell. Yet, there's a 10-inch steak knife buried in her chest, and Sam makes no mention of it, as though he doesn't see it, which is total bullshit. He's trying to get them to come out without telling them she's been stabbed because a stabbing makes it seem as though he's guilty, especially with the door broken down. So he says there's a lot of blood and she's on the floor, something that leads him to believe she might have hit her head. He doesn't want to say what happened, right? Because in this context, it can still look like an accident until they come to their own conclusions when they arrive. Yet, what he doesn't see coming is that if a person hits her head and subsequently loses blood and consciousness, the 911 operator is likely to request that the caller perform CPR, which is just a bit difficult given the big fucking knife in her chest. So when the 911 operator says, "Let's do CPR," Sam actually asks if he has to. He really does that. meaning, am I obligated to help my dying fiancé I found bloodied on the floor? It's so insensitive you can't even believe what you're hearing. But the point is this, if he says he'll do CPR, not only is he going to have to touch the victim's chest, right where the knife handle is, essentially implicating himself with physical evidence, but he's also going to have to tell the operator that the knife is there, which he doesn't want to do, because then it will require an explanation in a circumstance in which he's been told to feign as much ignorance as possible. Yet once the operator says, let's do CPR, and he feels obligated, it creates an endgame in which he has to mention the knife to get out of doing said CPR and touching the victim where that knife handle is buried. So he suddenly pretends, in like the manner of an epiphany, that he just realized, oh my God, there's a 10-inch knife in Ellen's chest, like he somehow didn't see it before. And the operator proceeds to, of course, tell him that he should now refrain from the CPR and stop touching the victim altogether, which is exactly what he wants. He then says she must have fallen on the knife, and then modifies that to say she could have stabbed herself. Clearly, behaving like this is going to draw a lot of suspicion, as we can see he's in survival mode in one form or another. But here's the thing. The physical evidence in no way shows that he has modified or manipulated this story. Rather, it's only in the telling that we appear to witness evasion on his part. Now, one of the elements that prevents some from seeing this as a suicide is the appearance of wounds on both the front and back of the victim. Like, would she really stab herself in the back of the head and neck? Yes. Let's consider horror movies for a moment, particularly the ones involving slashers. The killer is most often seen first in the film as being behind the victim, foreshadowing what's to come when they next meet face to face instead. The reason for this is that when you manifest the emotional idea of past, present, and future in a physical human body, what's behind is the past, where you stand is the present, or perpetual now, and in front is the future. So on an emotional level, what happens to us is that an issue from the past follows us into the future, and by lurking behind us before catching up. And then, when that problem catches up, it follows us into the future, trying to kill us, chasing us down, while we run, always putting it behind us again. Now, let's use a prominent horror movie to provide an example, one that includes a cleansing at a kitchen countertop performed by a killer who comes both from behind and the front to trap the final girl where she stands in the perpetual now, or the present. In Scream, the original movie, what was initially believed to be one killer turns out to be two at the end when the protagonist, Sydney, finally confronts them outside the kitchen. One is in front of her, and the other behind, no matter which way she turns. Sydney runs into the kitchen and goes straight to the countertop, specifically in the spot where the dishwasher is located, and hunches over with one arm crossed over her lower abdomen. What the universe is saying in symbolic imagery using the dishwasher, which holds cleansed white circles, is that you can't cleanse the circle to make it white. You must break the circle to make it the straight line, and the only way to do so is through extraction of the womb. So again, the straight line of her forearm defensively covers the womb. That happens through a disembodiment process involving AI, but since Sydney is refusing to evolve, the manifested horrors of her past and future selves come looking for her to force in tragic fate what she refused emotionally, and do so by way of the straight line, or the knife and gun. So, as she stands against the countertop, she has Billy behind her with a knife and Stu in front of her with a gun, both threatening to kill her. But then those two come together in front of her, literally merging until they touch, with their heads side by side, suggesting that they have become one entity from two separate entities. And this is the past and future merging in the now to bring tragic fate. And so the last thing they have to do, since the two of them have already merged, is to get inside her, meaning with the knife or the gun, which is a metaphor describing the fact that both Billy and Stu specifically committed this crime because they wanted Sydney for sex and couldn't have her. So, it's a failed transcendence narrative. They're failing to become the father. Using two teen guys as opposing ideals of not being able to get inside her, meaning one can't get inside her because she's a prude, and the other because she's not interested, manifests the idea of the protagonist not being willing to submit to her authentic self. So, it's come time to force change. So they appear behind, or the past, and in front, or the future, and then merge with Sydney in the present, or the perpetual now, all while telling her they're going to kill her by getting inside her with the straight line of the knife and gun, precipitating the necessary release of the red giant. So since they, past and present, have merged, all that's left to do now that they've converged upon the target, or the perpetual now, is to get inside her, or merge with her to become one, which is dealt with here in the context of becoming the father, as they've kidnapped hers and made him disappear. So Sydney fights back, changes, and slays the emotional demon, so to speak, from the past, ensuring that the future is corrected as well. Therefore, in her narrative, Billy and Stu, aka past and future, are killed and disappear, absent those horrors, while in Ellen's narrative, in this case, she didn't fight back, and therefore, when she was found, since it was an emotional issue, those manifested killers with the knife were no longer present because they had merged with her, aka killed her. So instead, all we find is her dead body. So instead of Sydney living, we have Ellen dead. Again, Sydney realizes the killer in front of her and then sees the one behind, which causes her to turn again and subsequently realize that either way she goes in trying to run will take her right back to the problem. The lesson is this: the only way out is through. That's how you break the circle with the straight line. And so, with the heart symbolizing the body of Christ and the straight line of emotional evolution the only way to transcend, Ellen chooses the shortcut of putting a blade, the straight line, through her heart, the red giant in its form of a circle, to compensate in symbolic imagery. Her way out, though a physical option rather than due to emotional change, still came as a matter of going right through to get out of her circumstances to escape. So she just manifests the idea of the only way out is through, but instead of the emotional line of evolution, it is the physical line of the knife. When peace can't be found emotionally, a person is left to find it physically. So think of the Delphi girls on the bridge. The killer approaches from behind, or the past, and when they turn to face him, he's in front now, before merging with them while holding the straight line pointed at them. Past, present, future represents the triangle of the emotional wound, which is easily found in symbolic imagery on Christ's crucifix. The three wounds, or stakes that cause them, create a downward-facing triangle on his body that is widest at its base on each hand and then narrows to a point below on the merged feet. As we ascend in our narrative and take flight, the notion of walking becomes obsolete, and it happens through merging binary necessity to become the singularity. So both feet are nailed together to signify that Christ can't walk. But if you look at the upper stakes, what you'll notice is that they cause positioning to make it seem as though Christ is spreading his wings, because he is. That triangle is a wingspan, and it represents taking flight through our evolutionary ascension narrative, or moving from a horizontally oriented evolution across Earth to a vertical one that will disembody us when we go back inside, or evolve through dimensions absent of embodiment, and therefore we're equipped with the body we're ultimately intended to shed and a mind we're meant to keep. The crown of thorns is simply a manifestation of a grouping of those emotional triangles, utilized to show how much pain will be caused emotionally, aka to the head, if we refuse to evolve and break the circle. This intersection of horizontal and vertical evolution is a junction that involves terrible suffering, so the crucifix simply manifests the idea of being pulled apart between opposing ideals of going forward and up to reach the top. Therefore, the triangle goes horizontally and vertically to a point. Notice that Christ is off the ground, suspended, but bearing weight. It's a manifestation of the suffering that will take place in the emotional idea of becoming weightless as God in disembodiment. Anyhow, that physical convergence of the seeker and the sought we see in horror movies is the past and future selves trying to merge in the present or the now and create the new you. So you essentially become a manifested version of the Holy Spirit, and that's how we get people in Scream looking back at Ghostface when they're killed. His straight line of the knife, after stalking them from behind in the past and in front of them in the future, converges upon the present and gets inside them. But since they have refused the new identity associated with the emotional change, Ghostface, absent of identity, is basically no face. It's waiting to be filled by whomever you were supposed to become, but never did. That's why masks are so popular in horror movies. On an emotional level, the thing we run from most is the monster we're becoming, an unknown so terrifying that we run and hide until we're forced to fight back and kill it, or worse, succumb to it. The idea is that the horror is supposed to follow you out of the past and into the future, or at first come from behind you intuitively and later in front explicitly, so that your awareness of it physically matches how you'd become aware of the emotional necessity of change. First, you're unaware, ignoring it in the past, then realize it intuitively, and finally, when it appears before you on your path headed into the future, you collide with it in a desperate plight for survival that forces you to change to accommodate. So the killer in a horror movie follows the same path of being unrealized in the unconscious mind and only intuitively felt, like when they appear behind the protagonist, and then slowly but surely they circle their way around to the front, becoming more explicitly realized until finally they're seen. The killer behind is the unconscious mind, which is only realized intuitively and not seen, while the killer in front is the rational or conscious mind in which you are able to realize the killer explicitly. Yet the junction between, in the form of your body and mind, or the perpetual now, represents the subconscious, and the subconscious is simply the gateway between those two worlds. That's what we are as individuals, nothing more than a gateway between that which is only realized explicitly in symbolic imagery or physicality and that which is only realized intuitively or based in emotional considerations. So when Ellen shows you that she was attacked from both the rear and the front, what she's manifesting is the convergence I just outlined here. But most importantly, the only sign of a struggle in this case is in her emotional life. There isn't one at the crime scene, which means that in all likelihood, it was actually in her head. So despite Sam's obviously suspicious behavior, I find this to be a suicide. There has been a call to investigate further, but there won't be anything to find beyond searching for reasons to blame the fiancé while, in truth, the woman he'd been living with was so desperate to suffocate herself by placing a bag over her head that, clearly, she didn't care about their future together. She was not any less selfish in this situation. Sam seemingly thought only of himself when she died, and I'm guessing it was because, on an emotional level, leading up to this, he knew she was ultimately going to do this to him. I see some really bad choices here, but none made in a context of malice. I don't think they were trying to hurt each other. Sadly, and to the contrary, I think they were actually trying to stop, and it became apparent death was the only way. I think the victim intentionally made the method of death as vague and convoluted as possible so that the resulting misdirection could accommodate enough suspicion about murder that nobody would prove it to ever be suicide. That desire is abundantly apparent to me from the structure here. What she seems to have wanted is enough to point the finger at Sam and enough to point it at her, but never enough to discern true fault. And do you know what that describes better than anything else? Just about every relationship we've ever had with another person in this life that once blossomed and then fell apart. Sometimes it's their fault when things go wrong, and sometimes it's ours. But in the end, no matter where we point the finger and assign blame, or regardless of what we choose to believe to get by, peace only comes when it's over, and never before. In Ellen's mind, someone was breaking down the locked door to her emotional world, and she was trapped inside. But since the truth is that our emotional problems are not embodied, the killer wasn't found in the apartment. He disappeared when she died, because he'd been inside her head. And because the harsh lesson was rendered through tragic fate, the monster never returned. But neither did Ellen. In their place, the only things that remained were the silence of a voice without words, a light without darkness, and the warmth of a father hidden within, calling on her to finally come home.